Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 849.MK0436, certificate number 26615, the NS Savannah.
The United States would seek more than the mere reduction or elimination of atomic materials for military purposes. It is not enough to take this weapon out of the hands of the soldiers. It must be put into the hands of those who will know how to strip its military casing and adapt it to the arts of peace.
And we talk a lot about climate change, don't we?
Like on the show or in general?
I think in general. You and I are always going for long walks talking about climate change.
Well, I think it's because we're walking through a 90-degree hellscape. That's why we're talking about climate change.
I love that you're talking about it. Seattle perspective, like it's a 90-degree hellscape.
You won't believe this. I had to put in air conditioning last year.
We've got listeners. It's 117 degrees right now.
I got back from Japan last week, and you know they always have hot muggy summers, but I think this was unusual. The day we left,
they're a great band, by the way. Hot Muggy Summers.
Hot Muggy Summers. Is it a Japanese group like Shonen Knife?
No, it's actually a. It's like a...
It's an Elephant Six band from Ruston, Louisiana.
That's exactly right. You got there before I did.
I was... on our last day there, it was 100 degrees in Tokyo, and I look at my phone app, and it says, real feel, 108 in the shade.
Real feel.
I guess they take humidity into account.
I'll give you a real feel.
Yeah. That's what I said to my phone weather app. 108 in the shade and 118 in the sun.
108 in the shade is something my dad used to say on the way on his CB radio.
Well, you really don't want 108 in the shade, particularly when you're trying to lead two teens through the cultural wonders of Japan.
Oh my God, I bet they were grousing.
They loved it. You know, these Seattle kids, they can't handle any temperature fluctuation.
I know.
Like it gets below 55 or above 75 and they're like,
I
call a doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah, climate change. Concerning.
Climate change. Yeah, I got a text last night from a friend in California, and they were like, oh, I just can't. Ugh. How are you? And I was like, 75, and the light breeze off the water is how I am. Sorry to say. Although we're not immune to it. The forest fires haven't started yet.
We used to worry about like the rising seas as being the big apocalyptic thing. But it turns out just everywhere being 120 degrees is worse than rising seas.
That's pretty bad.
Like it kills people.
Well,
you know?
And Canada burning every summer is a drag for us here in the United States.
But well, it's got to be a drag in Canada. To be fair, it's got to be a drag in Canada as well.
Okay. All right.
I'm trying to use my cultural empathy.
Yeah.
If I were Canadian, what would I think about Canada burning?
For the first time, you're worried about Canada. But, you know, around the world, right? There are temperatures just uninhabitable temperatures.
Hottest July on record, just wound up as we were recording this. And I think maybe the hottest day on Earth record on average just kept getting broken all month.
Yeah. And there was even a day down there in Death Valley where they were like, is it going to be 131 or whatever it is that is the line at which human beings can no longer successfully live?
Do the pupfish
live? They're down in the shade. They're 108 in the shade.
Real feel for pupfish.
Well, you know, we're always trying to talk about potential solutions to the climate change problem. And by always, I mean not very often, but sometimes you and I will sit and talk about.
It does seem like that's where the conversation should be. It shouldn't be the nihilism and it shouldn't be the denialism. And even more than the activism, it should be like the, what do we, you know, because we're at a point we can't fix it with human behavior. Like we're at a point where the fix will have to be technological.
Yeah, not using your hairspray or whatever it is isn't going to do it anymore. Everybody getting a Prius isn't going to do it.
Yeah, even if all fossil fuels went away tomorrow, the change is baked in. So,
the change is baked in.
Like literally.
What we need
is baking the pupfish.
What we need is solar-powered aircraft that have giant nets that collect dirty clouds and convert them into baking flour.
The planes are also mirrored on the top, bouncing sunlight away from us.
Bounce the sunlight.
And onto Venus, say.
Let's beam it to Venus. Well, see, where's your sympathy for Venusians?
Venerian climate change?
They're up there like, oh, why is it so hot?
Why is Earth glowing more than usual?
Yeah, why is there another sun in the sky?
Real feel, 800 degrees. This sucks.
Boo. I am somebody who believes in technological solutions. I know that that is one of the types of people that certain climate change activists like to yell at.
Yes.
Because...
Because tech got us into this problem.
Yeah.
And so, it's never solved any... Well, it's solved a few things. But,
you know, it's solved world hunger.
I would say tech has a mixed track record.
Sure. I mean, penicillin, yes. No.
New strains of rice, yes.
Sure. The car, I don't know. Which way do you put the car?
The car's a wash.
It's bad on smoke, but it's good at going to the drive-in movies.
Cute European streetcars, good.
Good.
Bad American cars, bad. Parking lots full of big American cars, bad.
Right. Ability to get very inexpensive polo shirts at your local Gap, I would say net bad.
No, well, not bad. All the kids in the sweatshops.
Well, no, I was just going to say from a style standpoint.
Oh.
Everybody looks like a caddy now.
Well, what are the real crimes here?
We're living in a world full of caddies and kids in their pajamas. That's the real problem.
You think the real problem is not child labor?
No, I think it's American kids going to school in pants that are clearly pajama pants. And that just begins, that's the beginning.
Going to the moon,
that's
good.
That's the beginning. Yeah, I think so.
Space shuttle program, bad.
Well, only in one or two senses, yeah.
Well, the two that blew up, what about the four that just did unexciting termite experiments for 20 years?
Yeah, we know a lot more about termites.
in orbit.
Yeah, I'm pro that. And we had all those funny astronauts that were sending videos down of them playing the guitar.
Doing head flips?
Yeah, that's all fun.
Head flips? That's not a thing.
Yeah, head flips.
So you can't do them on Earth. You got to go into orbit to do a good head flip.
Yeah, dude, that's the thing. We didn't even know they existed until we sent them into space.
We discovered head flips.
You know, almost 100% of the people that have gone down to the deep sea in deep sea explorers down into the Marianas Trench, almost 100% of them did not die in a submarine implosion.
That's true. It used to be 100%.
It was 100% until very recently. And then...
Is that going to be the...
Is that too soon?
Is that going to be the Chernobyl that dooms deep sea submersible tourism?
No, I hope not.
Wouldn't that be a shame if billionaires couldn't go to the bottom of the ocean anymore and survive?
I think what it did was it reinforced the idea that your bathysphere should be spherical.
And not a cool torpedo shape to fit in more paying customers.
Yeah, not something made out of carbon fiber that has like weird joints.
You want all that stuff to be done by the National Geographic Society.
Here.
And not weird.
Or the National Oceanographic Society.
And not weird startups.
No, that's not a startup environment. And I used to think startups were going to be great for exploring space. But now I'm sort of, I don't know, I'm neutral on that because of the people that run those companies.
When the good one is Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, that's
right. It makes
you
think.
Jeff, thank you for Blue Origin. Start launching those rockets. You know, those are good. Those are good for the local economy. Those Blue Origin rockets. They're employing a lot of space scientists here, and I keep running into them at seafood restaurants.
Yeah, but they're driving up the rents here. You know, space scientists are gentrifying Seattle.
No, they're buying up they're blowing up the rents down in Federal Way because that's where they all have to live. Because Blue Origin's down in Kent.
It is.
This is a lot of geographical comedy. You have to really live in King County.
I don't even know if it's comedy. Like Live would have had a Federal Way joke there. We just said Federal Way.
Yeah. And that
good one.
That constitutes a joke in the region. Right? Yeah, they could turn that Weyerhaeuser building into condos and
that would solve our rent problems.
Solve the housing problems and the space problems. Well, being bullish on technology, as you and I are.
Yeah, mostly.
I mean, we don't like to get yelled at by activists. That's our number one defining characteristic.
We don't care if we're right or wrong. We just don't want to be yelled at for being right or wrong.
Please don't yell at us about anything, let alone about technology solving climate change.
I feel like we've qualified our views on technology enough.
Yes.
We've seen old-timey cars without windshield wipers, and it seemed like a drag.
Literally, a lot of drag.
Well, and you had to, like, if it was raining, you had to lean out and, I mean, luckily you had those driving goggles.
And you weren't going that fast, but.
That's true.
But where do you stand? Here's the hot potato.
Uh-oh.
Where do you stand on nuclear power?
I feel like...
Nuclear power.
I feel like I was always pretty pro-nuke, even when it was
not
unfashionable to be so.
Yes.
And, but I wasn't doing the carbon footprint math, although today that makes nukes look pretty appealing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess you could tell it was cleaner in some ways.
There is still a lot of debate within the environmental movement, which used to feel like a movement, and now it feels like a balkanized movement or a splintered movement. And part of that balkanization is that there are still a lot of people very much opposed to nuclear power, both because it's, it's mining intensive in order to get all that enriched uranium. It's also still an environmental issue, what to do with that waste.
I got yelled at the last time this came up. I said, the waste is still a problem. And I got angry letters from people in that industry.
That said, no, it's not.
Telling me that, we just need to legalize the same kinds of remediation that the EU does. And I got bored at that point and didn't look into the regulations any further. But I know I got yelled at.
You know, a lot of people will say, all we need to do is make more Utah. And then you can put all that stuff in Utah.
We need more parts of America no one likes.
Yeah. Well, Utah, Nevada area.
Nevada desert.
Yeah. That area, if people didn't stand in the way of progress, you could just build deeper, deeper tunnels and fill them up with bombs.
Let me tell you the good thing about climate change. Yeah. More and more parts of America are going to be unlivable.
Yes.
And these are the parts where you can bury your nuclear waste. You
fill it up with waste. Exactly.
Problem solved.
If you go and read the lit on the anti-nuke people, a lot of it is the same stuff we've been hearing for a long time. Arguments about proliferation, arguments about disposal of waste, and the fact that they're intrinsically unsafe in that if there's an accident, it can potentially be like an accident that's larger in scope.
Yeah, the Fukushima or Chernobyl are worse than the worst things that could happen to an oil refinery.
Although, there's a lot of now sort of anecdotal evidence, at least, that Chernobyl did not become an uninhabitable wasteland. The wolves there don't have three heads. This seems like the animals are all
this,
just...
This seems like the ultimate hot take. Chernobyl's good.
Not good, but a lot of those disasters happen and you think, oh, well, then that land will be polluted for generations. No one's living in that area, but the things that are living there seem to be...
Seems like a real estate opportunity, John.
You would think there would be reports about a lot more two-headed pigs, and it seems to be everyone is surprised.
We need the Ukraine war to end so that you and I can start selling condos.
Well, there was all that laughter around the fact that the Russian soldiers went in there and dug a bunch of trenches.
Yeah.
And it was like, hey, there's a reason that we don't.
I won't let my kids dig a hole at Gasworks Park. I think Chernobyl might be a bridge too far.
But nuclear power, it ebbs and flows, and we're now living in a time that's kind of there's so little nuclear power industry, or rather, there's exponentially less nuclear power than there might have been in alternate universe America, where there weren't a couple of high profile accidents and people really, really doubled down on this as a safe and
clean
fuel during the Carter administration.
It does seem like the problems are solvable compared to the problems of a fossil fuel infrastructure.
Yeah, and a lot of the problems of those reactors were that they were being built during a time when American quality control was maybe a little bit...
you just need Lee Iacocca to take over the NRC or something?
There are a lot of people, you know, dozing. Like, do you think about... You watch that Chernobyl show.
Yeah,
amazing good. Show. And, you know, human error, right? In a lot of these cases, both human error in the initial engineering... Not that the design was bad, but you know, the concrete pourers skimped on them.
Flying over the Pacific the other day, I had a very visceral, sudden realization that I was just in a little tube hurtling through the air at a fatal height and fatal
fart
speed.
Tube full of long pigs.
Well, you know, but not just that, but like this is a inherently dangerous place to be.
Yes.
And yet statistically you look at how safe air travel became through smart machining and regulation. And you think, well, what if...
Frequent airworthiness checks, also, I might add.
So, you know, what if the nuclear industry was like that? Yeah, we're doing something inherently unsafe, like throwing atoms at each other. But, like, what if we have the same frequent checks and that the commercial air industry has? You would have... What if you had an accident once every never? Just like basically air travel works now.
Yeah, Nuclear Regulatory Commission also was... you know, this was an era where government was not especially efficient, not driven by the market forces that we know.
But today we know are infallible.
Whee! But one of the examples of safe nuclear power.
Atoms for Peace.
Well, we're going to talk about Atoms for Peace in a minute, but one of the examples is the United States Navy, which is currently running dozens of small nuclear reactors that are powering submarines and aircraft carriers and even cruisers and destroyers.
And you don't see a lot of CPOs with three heads.
No, and you also don't see a lot of accidents. The Navy is really good at managing.
This is my airline, the air carrier analogy.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you would think the Navy running all around the world. Now, this, I'm going to put the Russian Navy in a separate category here. But the number of nuclear accidents involving U.S. Navy reactors, pretty small number of incidents, right?
And I bet the number of announced official Russian ones is also very low.
So very low.
Although, I mean, I saw the one at the beginning of the new Mission Impossible movie, but that, I haven't seen another one in quite a while.
The interesting thing about a nuclear-powered vessel...
Nuclear vessel?
...is that when they launch, there's a lot of fanfare about them. So there's... It's not like there are a ton of them that go missing and nobody knows, right? I mean, maybe the Russians were launching secret nuclear vessels and losing them at sea and nobody knows about it, but that's probably not. Every one that comes off the old assembly line definitely has at least a notation in a document somewhere.
Maybe a huge parade through Red Square.
More likely, yeah. And in the United States, we're not losing reactors willy-nilly. We're kind of keeping pretty close tabs on them. So it is...
Good policy, I guess. Bipartisan. Bipartisan agreement that we should not lose any nuclear reactors.
And the reason that they are so successful in submarines... the reason that they're used in submarines, right, is...
Did you say submarine without the B?
Submarine.
Submarine.
Submarine? Submarine.
You're kind of swallowing the B. Submarine.
Submarine. Submarine.
I like it.
It's the Northwest, right?
We don't say every syllable, you know, every consonant.
Why waste all your time making Bs?
Exactly.
Subs, especially the subs, as we've discussed on this show, that are used as part of a nuclear deterrent cycle, the whole utility of them is that they disappear. And you don't know where they are, and they're sneaking around, they're lurking. And if you have to come up for air, you're not very good at disappearing. You can be found pretty readily.
Yeah.
And so nuclear power allows them to disappear and not come up for weeks and months and go under the North Pole and do all kinds of sneaky sub stuff.
They can be right off New York Harbor or Vladivostok.
Yeah, and because the reactors create such an abundant amount of power, you can use them to do power-intensive things like make oxygen and water out of, you know, make oxygen out of water.
I would be funny to think of what things aboard a sub are happening nuclearly. Like, if somebody heats up a hot pocket on the sub, like, why not just do that from the reactor, you know?
Well, we'll talk in a minute about microwaves and this technology, but all the electricity is coming from the reactor. You're not going to just put your hot pocket in the reactor.
That's what I'm saying. Skip the microwave.
Is there a part of a reactor that's so hot you could cook an egg on it? Yes, but also that will have mild radiation in it.
There's no part that's hot but not radioactive.
Yeah, or at least radioactive approximate. And the big ships, like the aircraft carriers.
The Enterprise?
The Enterprise.
I think it's across the bay in Alameda.
Oh, that's a Star Trek reference.
Yeah. You were doing nuclear vessels already.
No, that's just part of the popular culture. That doesn't mean I'm not going to sit here and quote Star Trek throughout this whole episode.
You were accidentally quoting Star Trek and you didn't even know it.
No, I know a reference to Wojohowitz.
Now, do you think Wojo, the Barney Miller character, is also a Star Trek character?
I always get them mixed up.
What if there was some Barney Miller character who's just a Soviet cop who's been dispatched to them like an exchange program, and he's always being like, "No, this was invented in Leningrad, Captain Miller,"
played by famous Russian comedian
Yakov Smirnov,
Vladivostok.
You know what people love about this show is when we do a long riff about Barney Miller.
All of our boomer listeners are like, "I remember that reference," or our Gen X ones too. But so aircraft carriers, of course, are enormous ships, but also they want to go really fast. And, you know, there's a formula within nautical engineering that the longer a ship, the faster it can go.
Really?
There's some formula an engineering formula that has to do with fluid dynamics, where the longer you make a boat, the faster you can go in it.
If I can make a boat infinitely long,
it could go infinitely fast.
It could break the speed of light.
That's right.
And that's my plan.
Zoom all the way around but it would have to be really long, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure at what point the law of diminishing returns comes into effect. Because all the laws, you know, there's a universal field theory.
At some point, water friction, you think, is I don't know.
I don't know either. It's all atoms, you know. Everything we're talking about is atoms. You're made of atoms.
Isn't that true of every show?
Mm.
Have we ever done a show not about atoms?
Hmm.
Probably not.
So aircraft carriers would require a ton of fuel just to cruise around the world for years at a time, and they would have to be trailed by like a flotilla of tanker ships constantly refueling.
Which is how the Air Force works.
Yeah, that's right.
But you don't want the phallic equivalent on the high seas.
Well, and just, I mean, think about, it's just extremely inefficient. And then, you know, you also, there is a formula of fuel consumption to speed that is kind of surprising that this isn't kind of more widely known. But the formula of fuel drag versus speed is one that has a quadratical increase, in the sense that in order to go up, in order to go twice as fast, you need four times the energy.
Much, yeah.
And so this is true also of a aircraft carrier fleet. And so every time you go up in speed, you're going to have, you know, twice as many ships in your flotilla. It's going to be a real drag. It's drag that's causing the problem.
I'm reading up on which other countries have nuclear navies, because this had never occurred to me.
Yes. You'll find not many.
Although some.
And France.
France does. It looks like maybe...
Russia.
It looks like maybe the UK does not have nuclear aircraft carriers.
They don't have aircraft carriers, but they do have submarines. But
all their bigger boats are powered by Wallace and Gromit-like gadgets?
Well, the thing about British aircraft carriers is that they're not the same as ours. No one in the world is making aircraft carriers like ours.
Yeah.
So they're like...
USA.
You know, that's what the Harrier was all about, like a jet that could kind of...
You don't have a runway.
Yeah, it could kind of go... It goes off a ramp. That's true of Russian aircraft carriers, too. They actually have a ramp at the end that kind of sends the jet up into the sky, hoping that then it can India get enough thrust?
India got its first native nuclear-powered submarine just in the last decade or so.
Yeah, isn't that exciting? And, you know, China is working on all of these things. But to run a proper American-sized aircraft carrier is a very expensive operation. And you got to fill it with airplanes.
There's an argument that maybe even America should not be paying that much.
Let alone all of the ones
Argentina or whatever.
But one of the news items that that has kind of made the rounds in the last 20 years is the idea of container ships as being major, major polluters in the global pollution economy, right? That in the last 30 years, the rise of container shipping, which we've touched on in quite a few episodes of Omnibus, and I've really been intending to do like just a specific sort of container shipping episode. But, you know, I don't want my episodes to always be the boring ones or the ones that are dealing with Cold War politics, ships, and nuclear power.
Just this one.
I just can't stay away. But container shipping...
You should have your own podcast just about container shipping.
Yeah, and airplanes. Container shipping and airplanes. Sign up on my Patreon. Container shipping has become a massive, massive part of the global economy, and part of that is problematic in that sort of World Trade Organization style, global manufacturing disbursement means that the U.S. stopped making stuff, and it's much cheaper to send stuff to Asia, have it manufactured and sent back than it is just to have people here to pay them a living wage and have them make things. And that has caused a lot of global problems, but
those ships are also just dumping stuff in the ocean.
Well, the thing about marine power is that there are a lot of different ways you can power ships. And although they're, a diesel engine is actually kind of the cleanest and most efficient way of driving a ship across the sea.
Okay.
Most container ships and most ships really are still using bunker oil or heavy fuel oil to run their boilers. I mean, they're basically...
Why? Older tech they don't want to upgrade?
Well, no, it's a lot cheaper stuff.
The fuel itself is cheaper.
Yeah. Bunker oil is like a thick sludge. You have to heat it up over 100 degrees just to get it to move. It's like heavy molasses.
That's nice for carrying.
Yeah.
Like what if we wanted to gas up your car and you could just get a handful of gas instead of one of those little orange containers?
Yeah, right. I mean,
I got to gas up my car.
It's like a schmoo.
Yeah, you pick up a schmoo of unleaded.
Yeah, like a little oily schmoo.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that is that's an old technology. The thing is that bunker oil or heavy fuel oil is 30% cheaper than any other kind of fuel. And there are grades of fuel like there are at your local gas station, and every one of them requires another iteration
of refining. Does it burn real dirty for the most part?
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. Heavy fuel oil is bad. And a lot of these fuels are very sulfuric. Now, when we talk about climate change, sulfur is a bad agent, but really it's
not a greenhouse gas, right?
It's not, right? Okay. Carbon.
It just makes acid rain or something.
Yeah. It's gross. And we've done a lot of work to remove sulfur from fuel, but carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide
fight the real enemy
are much more responsible for greenhouse effects than sulfur. And the thing about sulfur in fuel is that when we talk about the polluting of the cross global shipping industry, a lot of the more sensationalist statistics are based in a kind of sulfur measuring economy. I'm speaking specifically about a thought experiment that was suggested by a scientist by the name of Dr. James Corbett. In 2009, he was widely quoted saying that 15 container ships put as much pollution into the air as every car on Earth.
I've heard this kind of scare stuff before.
750 million cars are not making as much pollution as 15 ships.
But and that's true insofar as sulfur?
Yes. What has happened is since 1997, it used to be that we allowed as many as 300 parts per million sulfur in our gasoline. Mm. And we worked really hard to regulate sulfur in gas. And that has now declined to 10 parts per million sulfur in gas. So during that period, the 750 million cars globally, not universally, reduced sulfur, but enough that then becomes kind of it's not a statistic that truly demonstrates, you know, the relative production of greenhouse gases.
Yeah, because we're worried more about that than acid rain or whatever the effects of sulfur are.
But ships do still create a ton of pollution. Now, ships are the most efficient way of moving cargo around. If you're going to move containers from New York to Seattle, it's probably cheaper and more efficient to do it via a ship, put them all on a boat, water, than it is to run them across the country, certainly in trucks, but even in trains.
Yeah.
The argument of the argument about like the polluting nature of shipping is, you know, it's just like every argument about the modern world is it's a holistic problem. Like, is it that we're manufacturing everything at great distance from where it's being used? Yeah, probably. You could do a much better job in America ensuring that every step of the chain was green.
Go to something like going to some restaurant where everything was grown within 20 miles.
Yeah. Or even, I mean, there's now a new plant down in the South that's making denim on the old mills that were rescued from the Levi's mill plant, the white oak or cone, oak cone, white cone, oak, something, some combination of white cone and oak. There was a plant in the Carolinas that made denim in America. And, you know, this wonderful denim that was part of the Levi's story, and the plant just closed. Because you can get denim made elsewhere. And of course, there's a whole subset of weirdos in the world that are really, really into denim enough that
I'm sure it's weird that you know about this example.
I only know about it from, you know, reading about it sidebar
in Denim Weekly.
But, you know, some entrepreneurs bought all that old, all those mills, mm-hmm. all those looms, and have moved them down to Alabama or something and are opening a new denim plant. And apparently making denim creates a lot of waste and pollution. And so in rebuilding this factory, they're trying to make it also non-polluting and sustainable because that's where they grow the cotton.
It'll be like eco-denim.
Eco-denim!
Mr. Green Jeans.
Of course, every pair of jeans will cost $500. Yeah, that's the only problem.
But that's actually it's actually a draw for a lot of their audience, right? Well, I'd like to buy these more expensive eco-jeans, please.
For sure. Are you kidding me? You can right now go online. Just Google Japanese selvedge denim. I don't know anything about this. Like, I've never heard of it before.
Clearly. You don't know anything about JSD.
No, I'm pulling these words out of... out of the ether. Ken, you've been to Japan.
I have, recently.
What were some of the weird things you saw in Japan that you wouldn't see over here?
Well, they're not weird, John. They're just different.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like,
sleeping practices
were there
very
people
different.
Having sex with octopuses? I feel like that's weird.
No, only in animes. In real life, what happens is you get up from your room,
yeah,
and you go take some kind of a hot bath or soak of some kind.
That sounds pretty good.
You come back and they've turned your room into a bedroom. They've spread out your
Wait,
your mattress on the floor.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It had sitting stuff. It had like a table, and then suddenly you come back and they've made it into a bedroom.
Who's
they...
doing this? The octopuses?
No, the people who work at the ryokan.
Oh, I see.
A silent.
I get it.
A silent staff of helpful people. Because the
Are they like bred to be silent?
Yeah, they're kami. They're nature spirits. Like a giant
okay.
radish is hopping around.
I love it.
A fire spirit, a big water chestnut.
So none of this sounds weird to you.
No, this is totally normal stuff at any Japanese ryokan. The Japanese have really figured out sleep.
Yes.
Like a nice mattress on the floor
yes.
is a beautiful way to spend the night. And they've also figured out that we're doing pillows wrong in the West and have been for a long time.
Tell me more about that.
You know when a pillow is full of just like feathers or that chemical stuff, you lean back and the pillow just goes everywhere your head isn't?
I hate that.
Your neck is hanging back, maybe in a way that's not actually good for it.
Wait, are you saying that this is not just something universal, but this is a particular disease of the West?
Yes. I am pushing back on Western decadence.
Wow.
With the power of buckwheat.
Tell me something about the East that's gonna change my life. Buckwheat?
What if you filled a pillow with buckwheat and it kept its shape and firmness in exactly the size you put it?
The words that you're saying now are making me insane. What if you filled a pillow with buckwheat?
A pillowcase with buckwheat. This will change your life.
Okay. All
It'll
right.
change
okay.
your life. It's a more natural way to sleep.
Okay.
And Hullo makes its pillows, even though they're full of the ancient wisdom of the East.
Are there any anime radishes in them?
There are not, because okay. they're made in the USA with quality construction and materials and a no radish spirit
okay.
guarantee. It's certified organic cotton. The case is cut and sewn for durability. And the buckwheat is grown and milled right here in the United States of America.
So this is a concept from Japan, but it's been taken into the United States and now made thoroughly American.
Domestic buckwheat.
Domestic buckwheat, domestic sewing.
It's kind of like the Power Rangers TV show where we took the best of the East
mm-hmm.
and then mm-hmm. we filled it with some American ingredients and tricked kids into buying lunch buckwheat.
But this is not cultural appropriation because who would stand between anyone and a restful night's sleep?
And the Japanese are delighted to share their sleeping ways.
That's wonderful about
with
them,
us,
isn't it?
So if you ever have, if you have complaints about your current pillow, if you feel like it's not supporting your head, or
who
you have to,
doesn't,
or it makes you, it doesn't, it gets too hot on the one side.
The last time I walked through a city bus and said, "You got any complaints?" I heard a lot of pillow complaints. Frankly,
it's most people's. It's most people's first contact. And with this, it's got a zippered opening, the Hullo. So you can take in or you know, remove or add buckwheat to get it the shape and firmness you want.
That would never occur to me.
The thickness you liking. And that's how you wash the case, too. Just take out the buckwheat, wash the case, put the buckwheat back in. Easy peasy.
Huh. What do you know?
Lemon squeezy.
So what you're saying is go to hullopillow.com/omnibus and order a Hullo pillow?
Yeah, maybe order one for you, order one for a unique gift for a friend or loved one. You're going to get a discount of $20 per pillow if you order multiples of the right size.
Oh, that's kind of smart.
And here's the thing.
Tell me the thing.
It's a money-back guarantee. You can try this out for 60 days and 60 nights, more to the point. And if at any point you feel like, you know what, I'm going to go back to my weird, sloppy, squishy pillows, you can do so, and Hullo will offer you a full refund.
When it says 60 days, does it specify also 60 nights? Because it could be as few as 58 nights.
Depending on when your clock starts.
Yeah, right. If it starts the morning of day one and ends, you know, the evening of day 60.
Hullo has you covered.
Oh, awesome.
60 nights worth.
Nice.
Give it a shot. I think you'll find, as we have in my household, that Hullo Pillow is an intriguing alternative to old fuddy-duddy pillow tech.
And remember, 1% of all profits are donated to the Nature Conservancy to protect the endangered buckwheat.
Get fast free shipping on every order. And as I say, try it as a unique gift for family and friends.
HulloPillow.com/omnibus. The idea of nuke power and you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of new technology coming online around the idea of small reactors, right? The largest efficiencies in nuclear power generation are you make a huge reactor somewhere that's generating, you know,
the electricity for a state.
Yeah, gigawatts, 1.21. And then you're utilizing the power grid, right? And power grid dynamics and power grid flow, that's a huge industry. And putting big nuke plants in centralized locations and then sending that power out to everywhere is kind of the model. But more and more people are talking about small reactors, right?
Like this is the Mao equivalent. I want a backyard nuclear reactor.
Okay. Yeah, but the idea of a reactor that is the size of a shipping container or a couple of shipping containers being used specifically in certain industries in certain places where it's, you know, the need for power is kind of like an aircraft carrier, right? A specific thing needs to be done. One of the things is, a lot of the places in the world would be much more habitable if desalination plants were affordable. And desalination is an extremely energy intensive process. So in order to create enough fresh water that it is useful, a desalination plant on the ocean,
I see,
is just going to suck up energy.
But if you could put a little mini reactor out there.
Right. At a certain point, you can't. The water is more expensive to make than it would be useful in irrigation. You know, that water ends up being really expensive. Yeah. The only reason the Sinai Desert isn't a blooming oasis is that it's a desert. And if you had...
Isn't this true of all non-oases?
Yes.
The problem with this place that makes it not an oasis is the climate.
Yes, there's no water there. And there's actually,
think how lush it would be if there were a lot of water. I'd say more plants.
It's really funny. They say that the climatologists now feel like if you greened the deserts, if you had abundant water and went and turned the Sahara into a green oasis, that it would actually change the weather patterns enough that the Amazon would become a desert. Like there's no,
whoa,
you don't get the one without the other, right?
Like, well, unless you could get the water from somewhere else, like desalination.
Yeah. Wait a minute. If we put desalination plants, water everywhere, then the continents would all sink and we'd be just living in archipelagos.
The oceans would be very salty and all the sharks would float.
There you go. That's what, no. Desalinating, we'd take the salt out.
Oh, I'd put it all on land.
Yeah.
But you're taking water out too.
Nature grows.
As long as you don't put the salt back.
The seed.
You're saying you take the water out and put the salt. I'm saying you take the water out and put the salt back. You're saying, why not? We'll use some of the water, but we'll just keep the salt.
Pull the salt out, send it to Venus.
The white salt increases the albedo of the Earth, increasing temperatures on, reflecting more sunlight back into space.
There you go.
Heating up Venus.
But it's just the salt will solve climate change. We'll just turn a whole part of the Sahara just bright white. And it'll reflect all the sun back to space and temperatures will decline.
Perfect.
We've solved it all.
And all it took was common table salt.
Now, the idea of civilian reactors as a kind of not just anti-pollution, in fact, not at all anti-pollution, but as a kind of future technology, like exciting futurescape.
Yeah, jetpack stuff.
Was... really an Eisenhower administration promotion. Eisenhower was very conscious of he was president during the dawn of the arms race, and secrecy really dominated the kind of organizations around the technology. It was all very top secret stuff. And Eisenhower, being a man of the people, recognized that all of this secrecy was kind of toxic. It was creating in the country, a lot of fear because nobody knew anything about all they knew was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And
which Eisenhower was against, by the way.
Yeah.
I've been, having visited the Peace Garden in Hiroshima a couple of weeks ago, I've been doing a lot of reading. And Eisenhower was like, yeah, we didn't have to do that. It was a terrible idea.
Yeah. I mean,
he was nuclear skeptic, I guess.
Eisenhower, I think. I'm not new at saying that Eisenhower kind of is due
should be on the money.
A little bit more reflection on his, because, it was very popular in the 90s and 80s to say, you know, he was the one that was against the military industrial complex. It was Eisenhower that was the, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm doing a Ted Baxter voice. But
Ted Baxter always hated the military industrial complex.
I don't know, Mary. But Eisenhower and a kind of State Department group said, we need to start talking about nuclear energy as a way of both demystifying it and getting public buy-in on the idea of using nukes both to counter the Soviets.
I'm sure that's a big part of it.
A big part of it, but also to promote the American century, right? We are the ones that brought this online.
This is the power source of tomorrow. We don't want to be the ones who are left behind.
Well, and we're the ones that are going to spread it around the world. Mm. So, and you mentioned this earlier in the show, the Atoms for Peace initiative was an Eisenhower era attempt to be the Johnny Appleseed of nuclear energy. And we actually...
Big plot point in Oppenheimer, how much you share with your allies.
Is that right?
Yeah. You haven't seen it.
No, I haven't yet. Oppenheimer plays a role in this story just in the sense that he was part of this initiative in the Eisenhower administration. But
and he was in favor of more allied sharing, I think.
Yeah. We're the ones here in the United States that built the first civilian nuclear reactors in such dependable allied countries as Pakistan and Iran and Israel. And so it was really the United States trying to say, like, no, 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 nuclear power. And we did end up proliferating nukes in a way that maybe later, to some degree, we regretted.
Do you think at the time there was utopian thinking, like, this is the new clean energy we will make if our allies are prosperous, then not, we don't just win the Cold War, but humanity wins?
For sure, for sure. I mean, you're talking about flying cars.
Yeah.
And that was not just a part of the, like, science fiction dialogue, but it was part of the emotional management of the mid-century. This is how we're going to... The issue then wasn't climate change. The issue then was there'd been, 150 plus years of experiments with fascism. And so there was a lot of real desire to replace the fascist impulse with the democratic one. And how do you advertise that? What are the benefits? I mean, the fascist argument is that life is ordered and without chaos.
Yeah.
And the democratic impulse is, no, where there's freedom to be you and me, and prosperity.
And if that comes with cheap, abundant power.
Cheap power is the secret to prosperity, because the more aluminum you can process, the more cans of pop you can have at cheap prices, the more you can have your t-shirts made in China, really.
I mean, it could get cheap enough that you could just end capitalism, but I'm sure,
how are you going to do
I'm
that?
Sure Eisenhower wasn't thinking that far ahead.
How are you going to keep them down on the farm?
Post-scarcity society, baby.
That's
if
right.
Everybody can make their own aluminum in their home with a cold fusion machine.
You know, and it should be said that also during this period, under Eisenhower, we went from having 1,000 nuclear bombs to 20,000 nuclear bombs. But as part of this, Eisenhower specifically said, look, we need a nuclear-powered cargo ship.
Just one?
Well, as a demonstration.
It's like a floor model.
Yeah, this is a thing we should build that we then tour the world and show off our technology.
It's like a model home.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Move on in.
Exactly. And so he says, he commissions a ship that's going to be a technology showplace. That's going to be a goodwill ambassador for the Atoms for Peace initiative. And also, you know, it's like Radio Free America. It's going to tour the world and everybody's going to kind of come on board, tour around. It's like taking Khrushchev to the World's Fair.
I mean, imagine a world of John Roderick's where everyone is just blown away by a new kind of cargo ship.
Yeah, just like, whoa.
Well, let's abandon our previous form of government. Look at this.
What? This one doesn't use any bunker fuel. And so they set about building this ship, and at great expense. It probably cost $400 million in today's money.
I mean, there's already nuclear vessels in our Navy, right?
There
we didn't do this
time.
First.
That's
like
right.
Enterprise and maybe Nautilus or whatever.
And this wasn't the first nuclear-powered civilian vessel. The Russians beat us to it, just as they beat us to space. And what they built was a nuclear-powered icebreaker, because that's a big part of the Russian attempt to be, you know, to...
That's really their whole vibe.
It's their vibe, right? Like...
We don't have good ocean access. We don't have icebreakers.
They don't have any tropical ports. And so icebreakers are big. And still, in the Russian fleet, nuke icebreakers are still, I think, at the present moment, some of the very few nuclear-powered civilian ships.
Well, again, climate change is going to solve this problem, too.
There you go. That's right. There won't be any ice up there. It'll be tropical beaches all across the North.
Look out for the Soviets.
So they commissioned this ship, the NS Savannah, the nuclear ship Savannah. And it's...
Is NS a prefix we actually use? Or
we don't, because there aren't any nuclear ships. But,
so they just invented this,
yes.
Like, because it's part of the branding of it.
Yeah.
Like they're trying to sell a new iPhone or something.
It's a USS, except it's an NS.
Because a normal civilian ship, would it even have a prefix?
It would be the SS. SS Titanic or the...
And the first SS, nothing to do with its source of power, right? I mean, at some point, were they steamships?
Yeah. In fact, most of these bunker oil ships that still sail the ocean are steamships. I mean, the oil is being burned to power a steam engine. They're not diesel engines.
I guess it makes sense because that is the origin of the SS. It is a steamship.
Steamship. And the Savannah was the first steamship to cross the Atlantic Ocean. The original Savannah, the namesake Savannah.
Oh, I see. So this is like hearkening back to another pioneering vessel.
Yes. The early 1800s, the Savannah made that journey. And then, this is the one it's the new Savannah. It's just like naming the USS Enterprise.
Right.
The Enterprise. So the Savannah, it serves a lot of masters. It's designed not only to be a nuke vessel, but also a really cool looking boat.
So it doesn't look like your grandpa's cargo ship?
No, it's super hot. And they also decide, in addition to it being a cargo ship, they're also going to make it a cruise ship. So they put a swimming pool.
Really?
They put 30 very deluxe cabins.
So it's a passenger.
Yeah.
That is, you'd be taking people across the ocean as well.
Yes.
Who don't mind going at NS speeds.
And that seems really cool, right? There's like a big ballroom and a dining hall. And in a way, it's very akin to the SS United States. Except the SS United States predates it, both in propulsion, but in style too. The SS United States was a very deco modernism.
This is 50s, and so what does it look like?
Super mid mod.
It's got big fins on it.
No, but it's a beautiful, beautiful white ship that has because the reactor is in the center of the boat. They moved the superstructure toward the back, kind of like a freighter. But the way they designed it. It's really badass.
Well, it kind of makes it look like it has the long hood of a Lincoln Continental or some super long car that just keeps going and going. It's really good.
Yeah, and on the side of the ship, it's got a logo of an atomic, an atom with electrons flown around it. But inside, like the decoration of it, is very Danish modern. It's got all of the, it kind of feels like a nice hotel in Anaheim.
I'm looking at the orange, chairs. Like it's straight out of, what was that? Project Cybersyn or whatever.
It's exactly right. So the ship then goes, it takes a while, it's initially commissioned in 59, but it takes until 62 to actually get the reactor up and running.
And how is this going to work practically? Like how much is the U.S. government managing its itinerary?
A lot. All.
Really? So it's not actually...
It's being managed by the U.S. Maritime Administration, which was a much more significant part of the U.S. apparatus than it is now.
Yeah.
Right? Like merchant marines
Is that still a thing?
I guess. It's still a thing, but it used to be a huge part of the, well, it's an auxiliary of the U.S. Navy.
Yeah.
All those ships were also designed with a World War II mentality to be able to be converted to troop ships.
Called up.
At any time. But yeah, part of the standardization of shipping means that there are fewer sailors and fewer merchant marines of all kinds, right? The more ships you have and the more automated it is, the fewer sailors you need.
Right.
So the U.S. government not only was sending this boat around as a goodwill ambassador, but they were also subsidizing it. It was expensive to run. The ship needs more crew and they need to be highly trained. But also there's zero infrastructure for a civilian nuclear ship around the world.
It's sui generis.
Yes. Everything has to be bespoke, including a ship that sailed around just to service it.
Really?
Because on its early tours, you know, it had all this water that was part of the cooling, and that water is mildly radioactive, not terribly radioactive, and they were just dumping it overboard.
Don't tell the guests on the shuffleboard court.
Which is fine in the sense of it being out in the ocean, but eventually it was like, you know what, that's not fine. And so they had another ship that sailed with it that took its bad water. There actually was a whole place on the ship, like a lab, where they tested passengers to make sure they didn't have so much, they weren't irritated.
Everybody wears one of those little badges that turns black.
Yeah. So, but the ship went and really made a grand tour of the world. In fact, on one of its first voyages, I mean, the first thing it did was sail down to Savannah so everybody could honk and wave. And then it went through the Panama Canal and came to Seattle for the World's Fair.
Oh, wow.
And it parked here, and it was one of the many displays that people visiting the fair could go down and tour the ship.
I never thought about ships at the waterfront being part of the fair, but I guess it must have, yeah.
Yeah, well, and this would have been like a really dramatic and cool-looking boat that perfectly dovetailed with the message of Century 21.
Kennedy, New Frontier stuff.
But then off it went, and in the course of its, you know, of its life in the mid-60s, it visited 45 countries around the world and had 1.5 million people come tour the boat.
I thought you were going to say 1.5 million Instagram followers.
It had 1.5 million different people that died of having of three-headedness as a result. But it was expensive to run, and a lot of this was that changing the fuel. None of it was standardized. Everything had to be done specifically for this ship. It cost $2 million more than it was earning in container shipping and presumably passenger tickets.
So it was doing that on the side.
Like it was.
It was doing its goodwill visits, it was also doing actual merchant marine work.
But the thing about the cargo hold was that it was, it was kind of the old school where the pointed bow of the ship would open clamshell style to move stuff in and out.
Oh, wow.
And as the technology of ports started to transition to kind of a more automated, this was very early container shipping days, but the ship was inefficient to load and unload. It could only carry 8,500 short tons of cargo, which was it was a fraction of what a ship even then could carry.
It's a prototype,
right? Yeah. And so by 1971, I guess by 1980, or I'm sorry, by 1965, they had already decided that they weren't going to keep carrying passengers. So it only had a run of 3 years where people were sitting in the swimming pool, you know, slightly boiling, before they were like, yeah, that's not really how this ship's going to get used.
But that's even funnier now that for a few more years, there's a container ship going around with this luxury passenger area.
Well, it was part of the tour, right? When they pulled into, when the ship pulls into Karachi and people line up to tour it, the passenger cabin is intact. So everybody can come and look into the staterooms, and it still is communicating American modernism.
That's probably more fun to tour than any of the actual cargo decks.
The rest of it's just stupid and boring.
Yeah.
But by 1971, it's clear that the ship is not an efficient way of doing any of this. And it's, you know, it has performed its function as a goodwill ambassador. And so in 1971, they shut it down. Now in 1971, the cost of bunker oil for container ships is $20 per ton. But by 1974,
oil crisis,
the price of bunker oil has gone up to $80 a ton, at which point the NS Savannah actually would have been competitive price-wise with other container ships.
Who could have predicted?
Right. It's the old, close the elementary school 4 years before there's a huge influx of new kindergartners.
Right.
Now, currently, looking at today's global 20 ports average, the cost of bunker fuel is 647 pounds, or 647 American dollars per metric ton.
So inflation has gone up somewhat, but not 30 times. That's
that's 100 times more.
Right.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. It's a lot more expensive than, it's outpacing inflation.
Yeah.
By vastly.
But the nuclear powered ship did not ever catch on globally. After the Savannah was decommissioned, there never really was any attempt to build a nuclear powered civilian fleet globally, even as shipping blew up.
Why not?
Well,
concurrent decline in the prestige of nuclear?
That's part of it. It's a classic example of the startup cost of a thing being perceived as prohibitively expensive to ever convince an entire industry that the ultimate savings would pay for all the infrastructure costs that would be necessary up front.
A lot of upfront costs.
So, you know, the global nuclear-powered shipping world is almost entirely military and, you know, really tight protocols, secure environments, highly, highly trained technical staff. Now, all of that technical staff, all of those nuclear-rated sailors, when they rotate out of the Navy, they have this very specialized skill set that's highly prized within the armed forces. To be a nuke tech is a big deal. But there aren't a ton of civilian jobs. You know, if you get out of the Air Force, you can go fly for Alaska Airlines. But what do you do if you get out of the Navy and you're like a petty officer who's been running a reactor?
Jimmy Carter became president, but...
There you go.
What do the rest of them do?
What do the rest of them
do? They can't all teach Sunday school.
You know, they're all greeters at Walmart. No. But there never was a kind of critical mass of thinking that said, and a lot of it was a result of precisely during that energy crisis era, it was also peak suspicion about nuclear power, specifically as a movement from the environmentalist standpoint, right? This is a dangerous source of power. It's not necessary. It's not safe. And shipping especially kind of felt like an unregulated, you know, if we had a Chernobyl out at sea, if you had a Chernobyl in a port, if a ship was in New York Harbor and had an accident, like it could be really, really devastating. And it seemed... And even now, in the popular imagination, you don't say, oh, there are reactors in submarines everywhere you look. There's one in New York Harbor right now, I bet, that we don't know about. And we trust, to whatever degree we trust the military, that those things are not dangerous.
It looks like maybe 3-4% of the greenhouse gas emissions is
shipping.
Container shipping.
And increasingly within shipping, there is a you know, a considerable movement away from bunker fuel and into better fuels. There are a lot of different kinds of fuel. There's heavy fuel oil, and then there's marine diesel oil, which is very low sulfur stuff. Sulfur isn't obviously the only problem, but then there's ultra low sulfur fuel, which is called marine gas oil. And I really want to say, is it a gas? Is it an oil? Figure it out. But then there's also liquid natural gas as a potential fuel source for shipping. And then, you know, there, who knows what the future of biofuel is. But shipping is very aware of itself as a polluter. Maersk, which is the big Danish shipping company, has pledged, initially they pledged to be carbon neutral by 2040, and then actually on their own, under their own auspices, moved that date up to 2030.
Presumably because they're on pace. I mean, they think they can, they think, yeah, they see a path.
Yeah. And they're, you know, their shipping is working to, I mean, 3% of global greenhouse gas, that's also basically what aviation contributes.
Yeah.
So aviation also tremendously polluting. Now, what that means, of course, is that 90% of emissions are coming from somewhere else, mostly power plants. No. I mean, you know, coal burning power plants around the world.
Well, yeah. I mean, by us, I just meant,
oh, human beings,
people lighting their homes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the rise of China as a industrial, it's another thing about the cheap polo shirts is that, the countries that are making those things are dumping their plastic in the ocean.
Powered by dirty coal.
Yeah. And using the worst kind of coal. But,
I mean, it's possible that renewables are, I mean, just in a broader philosophical sense, that renewables like, you know, wind and solar are, you know, moving or advancing so fast that nuclear might have missed its moment.
Well, it's really hard to exactly say what, yeah, you know, because battery technology needs to also be increasing at an exponential rate, and batteries all of a sudden were dependent on certain, you know, rare earths,
metals, yeah,
that then, you know, mean that Chile and Russia are the countries that have a monopoly on these things. I mean, all this technology, you and I both technology boosters, and it is a sort of race to the finish. The regenerative or the you know, the true environmentalists do want to believe that it's going to be solar and wind. We thought for a long time it was hydro until we realized how destructive that was in ecosystems.
Yeah.
We still up here in Washington leave all our lights on all the time because we have the dams that are just giving us basically free electricity.
Salmon hate it, but we love it.
We love it. And the problem is, again, the grid also requires, I mean, the grid is its own technological solution that's based around the idea of big power plants. Is it possible to build a tiny reactor that would power a jet? Is that a better fuel source than hydrogen? Or
it does seem more likely than wind or solar for a jet, but yeah, maybe. Yeah,
I mean, how,
maybe it's hydrogen.
Where you're going to get an electrical grid that's going to provide the electricity and how you're going to build batteries? I mean, there are electric airplanes now, and that's a very new and potentially like explosive field. Are you on a
explosive
list?
Explosive in a good way or bad way?
Hopefully in a good way. Are you on a list to get one of these new electric hover cars?
I just feel like the plug would be so, the cord would be so long.
Ha ha.
And that concludes the NS Savannah, entry 849.MK0436, certificate number 26615, in the omnibus. As social media collapses around our heads, we used to do jokes about the obsolescence of social media, but I bet we didn't think it was going to happen in like 3 years.
Boy, we sure didn't. We were like, oh yeah, when there's no more Twitter.
To the degree that that still exists, you can find us at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings and not John Roderick, at various places. Facebook, that's where the futurelings are congregating. Facebook, Reddit. Basically, the whole internet is in decline, but as long as it exists, there will be Futurelings making the best of it.
You know where it's growing? It's growing on our Patreon, Ken.
That's true. That's where the magic is. Mm-hmm. Go to patreon.com/omnibusproject while you're at it. Just take 30 seconds right now. Right now while I'm talking, take 30 seconds to see the amazing variety of perks and prizes available to those who support the show.
Do it. Perks and prizes.
To the tiniest degree. Like $1 a week gets you the best perk, which is the bonus show.
Give us $5 a week. That's my suggestion.
That would be, let's see, 25 a month. That gets you a pretty good benefits. I think that, does that get you to the t-shirt? I don't know. Check it out at patreon.com/omnibusproject. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com to complain about my understanding of nuclear waste. Or send us things. Don't send us spent nuclear fissionable materials.
No, if you have any of that on hand, what is going on? What has gone on that...
And don't send it through the mail. Those guys get mad if you send a battery. They're not going to want you to send uranium. But we do get stuff at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. We just got a note from Bruce, who sends us... Yeah. He will not let us down. He's sending us two books about Lowell Thomas.
Hey, Lowell Thomas, my dad's old pal.
Wait, is that true? Well, yes, that's right. His
Lowell
son.
Lowell Thomas Jr.
His son, yeah. So his dad, I believe, is the character played by, it's not William Holden. Who is it? He's in Lawrence of Arabia, right? He's the American journalist in Lawrence of Arabia.
That's right.
There we go. Wikipedia describes him as an American writer, broadcaster, and traveler, best remembered for publicizing T.E. Lawrence. He also was involved in promoting the Cinerama widescreen system, which is ironic since I've seen Lawrence of Arabia on our Cinerama screen.
You and I saw it together
quite a few times
on Cinerama. Did we not?
Yeah, we went.
Yeah, we did.
It is not William Holden, and it's bothering me that I can't remember who it is. Some weirdo is yelling at the show right now.
Who is it, if not William Holden?
It's not Jack Carter, is it? Or is it? Ah, it's Arthur Kennedy. One of these kind of balding guys. And they don't call him Lowell Thomas in the movie. They call him Jackson Bentley. But it's Lowell Thomas.
I met Lowell Thomas Jr. several times. My dad and he were frequent collaborators.
So, this note is taped to a sports page. Did you know those still existed?
No.
It's Seattle Times. This is local. But here are both volumes of Lowell Thomas's autobiography, I guess. Let's see. They are called Good Evening, Everybody, From Cripple Creek to Samarkand. And then So Long Until Tomorrow, From Quaker Hill to Kathmandu. You know, he was one of these 20th century adventurers.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? That was what I always imagined I would be.
Ooh, these are signed.
What?
The second one is signed. The set is signed. Let's put it that way.
Nice.
Wow, where did... I wonder where Bruce got a hold of this. Oh, no, here we go. You'll notice that both books are signed by the author. Oh, with the second one being signed upside down on the inside back page.
Cool.
I guess. I think he was just signing very fast by accident.
Does that mean it's not a collector's item? If it's
maybe it's more so.
Yeah.
Bruce really recommends these books, saying Lowell was a good storyteller. I won't mention any specific highlights for two reasons. One, there are so many, and two, because neither book has an index. All right. Well, maybe you and I as a fun project could index Lowell Thomas's two-volume...
That does seem fun.
Two-volume autobiographical bestseller from the late 70s. Thank you so much, Bruce.
It seems like a weird thing that we would have done in some earlier incarnation of ourselves, and these days something that we would say that we would do and then never do.
I think I always would have said I would have done it and never done it. Thank you, Bruce. Oh, wait, there was something else here. Oh, yeah, Sparky sent us a postcard from Alberta, the Alberta Railway Museum. He notes that his grandfather actually worked on the Northern Alberta Railways, and he's glad there's a rail museum that keeps some of their equipment safe from the scrapping torch. It's true. There is no shortage of regional museums keeping locomotives and aircraft around.
But you know what Alberta is full of? Scrapping torches.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Scrapping torch capital of Canada? Yeah, they make a lot of money
up there scrapping things with their torches.
Unlike our correspondent from last week, he actually paid the extra money to send this from Canada, where apparently it costs $1.30 to mail a postcard.
But that's Canadian money.
Yeah, that's like 8 cents. Thank you so much, Sparky, for keeping us up to date on your travels. Send us postcards. Why not? If we're very boring or we want the show to be long, we'll just read them now for no reason. I have no sense of urgency about getting out of the show for some reason.
Well, because it's still early. Still early in the day.
Blah, blah, blah. Patreon did that. I feel like I kind of covered it.
I think you did. I think you covered all the bases. I didn't tell you what happened to the NS Savannah.
Oh, yeah.
Where's the Savannah? Well, it went to Savannah for a while as their namesake. It shelled around between a few museums. Eventually, they took the reactor out of it and took the reactor to Utah and dumped it in a hole somewhere. And then the Savannah itself is declared like a national landmark of some kind. The interior is still intact with all of its cool orange couches. And
so when it was at museums, it could be toured.
Yeah. And I think was a popular tour, except it was at the same port where the USS Yorktown is featured, and everybody was going to the Yorktown, and nobody went to the Savannah.
Not me. I'd go to the cool one.
Anyway, they towed it up to Philadelphia, and for a while it was sitting there next to the SS United States, or nearby, and then now it is in Baltimore, in the harbor in Baltimore, sitting in a dock. Someone that I kind of know that is like a urban spelunker actually sent me some pictures where the dock, although it has a sign that's like, keep out, the gate was open, and they just like...
They didn't go aboard the ship.
But they walked down and they were like, this is it. So it's there. And if you are in Baltimore, in the Baltimore area, we've had futurelings send us pictures of the SS United States that they realized from listening to the episode and then went and found.
Yeah.
So we encourage futurelings in the greater Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area to make a pilgrimage up to the Port of Baltimore and take some pictures. Send us pictures or post them on the Futurelings page of the Savannah. And
but you can't go aboard anymore, is that right?
No, but the idea is that it would be kind of like the SS United States. Yeah, that it would
if they
be,
can get public funds.
Yeah, or some billionaire decide to retrofit it. There are instances, there were a few other nuclear ships done as sort of experiments over the decades, usually other countries. And there were a couple that were actually converted to diesel and ply the seas. So maybe you take all the irradiated stuff out, put a biodiesel motor in there and make it a super yacht.
Corn farmers would be delighted.
And you'd be shipping, maybe you'd be breaking Russian blockades, taking your grain to market. But so it's there. It's still there, and it's still intact. And so far, I haven't found any ashtrays on eBay. So
it's a good sign.
It lives. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, but we hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese.
And or cheese.
And an almost complete lack of nuclear poisoning. And hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.